Okay, so good morning. Welcome to the first session of the day. It's my special pleasure to introduce a man who probably needs no introduction here. So it's up to you, Ted.
Oh my. Didn't expect that to happen right then. Hi, I'm Ted Dunning. I'm going to be talking about some work that I did with a customer recently using Drill on an extremely large data set. Now, aplomb, I was just informed that that is not a common word. Aplomb is not an Apache project.
Yeah.
It's an adjective. So, let's fix that. Not aplomb, with Apache Drill. Okay, that's more straightforward. My name's Ted Dunning. I'm an Apache board member, but that's not what I'm doing here today. More an early Drill contributor. Although not so much lately. I follow the mailing list and occasionally make nasty comments. Aman can confirm that. But I'm a Drill enthusiast, at the very least. You can reach me via Apache, the Apache mailing address. I'm also CTO at MapR. MapR built a data platform. That's how I got to talk to these people. You can reach me if you want to talk to me, MapRish. At that email, or you can just talk to me. That's my personal email at the bottom. So, let's get going. Now, part of what I want to talk about today... Come back. Should never have moved that. Let's just try the classic replug.
He just rebooted that.
Oh.
It's just flipping.
I moved the computer, so I think there might be a slightly loose connection. There we go. We're back.
I saw from the hall that one not on, so I started investigating.
I think we're stable. So anyway, part of what I want to talk about here today is that there's been a transition. It used to be that when you do this big data sort of thing, that, come on over. For one thing, you won't be able to hear me over there. Is that it used to be that the only problem that you really had to solve was the data was really big, and that people would put up with anything if you could just do something. That's not true anymore. People have all kinds of other constraints. They actually want the results to be correct. In fact, they didn't used to care about that all that much. If you got any results at all, it was amazing. Now they want it to be correct. They also want you to follow the rules. What? Rules? The knife fight? Well, now there are, because big data is actually beginning to handle data that's important, that has privacy constraints, that has legal constraints, that you can't reveal before you've qualified it, things like that. And then the other, and this is by far the biggest problem, is that ordinary people want to be able to use the system. Used to be that if I was working on a project, if I could show something or get some result, that was good. That was fine. But now we suddenly, we're going to want hundreds or thousands of users to get in on this. And so the big data game is changing pretty radically because of all these aspects. And so part of what I want to show today is not something that's amazing. What I want to show is something that's amazingly easy to do. I just warn you, because otherwise we're going to get to the end of the talk and you're going, I could have done that. Well, yeah, that's the point. You know, a lot of times I might give you a talk about what amazing thing I can do, but the real point here is that this becomes an enabler for just folks, people without superb wizardly skills, that they can succeed at this. And so that's just a warning. At the end, you're going to go, oh, so? But this is actually a hard problem. So the first example I want to talk about, and I can't talk in a lot of detail. In fact, I'm probably on the edge of freaking these people out, so I'm not going to tell them I'm talking about this today. There is nothing that I'm going to tell you that's It's secret. But as a level of sensitivity, I built a random number generator for this data. Just random numbers. And I didn't ever see their data. So I didn't even know what format their data was in. I was just guessing. And they freaked out and called our CEO and said, "That looks like our data. Are you disclosing this stuff? You know, you have to pull that down from GitHub immediately. It's like, it's random numbers." So we're going to talk about the problem in general, not the specifics. Don't ask. But the basic problem is they have DNS logs. Now, it could have been phone calls. It could have been all kinds of things. Basically, there's who did it and what did they do? What IP did they come from and what did they look up? The reason that this is important is because you can spot a whole lot of bad actors this way. People who have taken over somebody's computer, well, that computer starts looking up the command and control points for whatever the takeover was. Or people will use DNS to try to tunnel information out of a system. Well, the DNS logs tell you about that. So this is actually, come on over if you want to be with us. We're happy to have you. The DNS logs are actually really cool security-wise. Now, one interesting thing also is because these guys do control the network, they can lock out, I don't know if they do, but I know that a lot of people do, they can lock out access to external DNS, so everybody inside is forced to use their DNS. So it's actually a very, very interesting choke point for security purposes. But if you've got millions and millions of customers, they do billions and billions of DNS lookups. Happens all the time. And if you want to keep months or years of that data, you got a crap load of data. And they want to be able to search this stuff like that. They don't want to be running these big jobs that will finish someday. They want users to be able to explore stuff. So, very high volume insertions. They're okay with only inserting every 10 minutes or every hour. They don't need it necessarily in real time. But they do want vast amounts of insertions. They also, obviously, at the other end, want to be able to delete that data at the same rate. They want sub few seconds. Doesn't have to be massively sub-second queries. The users do understand it's pretty big. But pretty slow to them means a couple seconds. Again, there's no chance they're going to be able to launch a Spark query and go through Parquet files, things like that. And it has to be able to also do big queries that will take a long time, that will be very complex, that will have like self-joins across trillions of things. And they have to be able to support that on the same system at the same time. They also then, as I mentioned, have trillions and trillions of rows and billions and hundreds of billions of inserts and deletions pretty much continuously. So one of the things that isn't here but is implied is multi-tenancy. Different kinds of workloads on the same system. And, oh, by the way, they said we could only afford enough nodes to store the data, not to store the data in a test system. So all of the QA, all of the staging, all of the testing of the system also has to be multi-tenant on the production system. And this is also a trend that we're seeing. More and more and more people are saying, hey, live production, critical stuff, and stupid idiot trying something has to live on the same system. So, yeah. Both. And so the question was, are these ad hoc-ish? I'm going to steal that word because that's really a good way to put it. Or are they predefined? Well, there's a lot of predefined queries for dashboards and things like that, like how many people exist in the universe this week. But then there's a lot of, this is true of all security sort of situations, the bad guys figure out eventually how to evade whatever you're looking at. And so you have to change what you're looking at. So ad hoc-ish, as you're trying to deal with some situation, is definitely a big part of this game. Now, a lot of the users, there's thousands of users in this case, a lot of these users are not sophisticated enough to write SQL. They are sophisticated enough to click on data selections and drag certain things, and then that GUI can produce a SQL query. Very often it will produce a weird SQL query with odd structure and elaborate and pointless pieces. So that's what we're going to see. And for storing, you know, at least petabytes, possibly tens of petabytes, their hardware budget is very tight. This is a little bit crazy, guys, sort of thing. DNS queries, source IP, target domain. But then there's a lot of secondary information that you get, like when did it happen, what part of the network are they coming from, things like that. People want to be able to query by CIDR, meaning this IP address, but masked only for 24 bits. So it might be any of the swath of machines that you want to query by. Or you want to say, they searched for this Google subdomain, com.google.something. You want both of those kinds of queries. And you want to combine those, too. So you can't just say, here's a primary key. So, like HBase, sorry folks, it just isn't going to happen. Time is of the essence. Every query essentially has some time elements in it. For this hour, for this day, for this week, and so on. For an hour last month. User sophistication is low, which means the query complexity is higher than you'd expect. Not all the requirements are known in advance. This is a security app. The bad guys are changing things. Therefore, somebody's going to say, oh, yeah, we should have told you that. This is a new requirement. Okay. Now, another thing that they want to be able to do is they apparently have a pretty high unreliability on data inserts. And I don't understand what their problems are, but I think it's probably the classic sort of things that they have some brittle parser, and it's cruising along, and it's got 99 billion out of 100 billion inserted, and it goes, oh, somebody put a comma in the wrong place. I'm going to quit. Well, they cannot have those 99 billion visible unless all 100 billion are visible. And when they do redo the insert, they can't have those 99 billion doubled. That's not that weird, but it's a pain in the ass at this scale. Now, it's not such a problem if we were doing file-oriented data. We would just do a move on a Parquet file and kabam, it would appear. But because of their tight query parameters, we can't be doing it in a file level sort of thing. We can be doing the archive stuff in files, but the live stuff has to be in some kind of table. They also absolutely need secondary indices. They need kind of quirky secondary indices that are sorted on different parameters. They need the secondary indexes to actually cover columns. That means that many of the columns are actually copied to the secondary index table, and that means if you query on those columns, you don't have to go back to the primary. That's really good some days. But all of that has to be completely transparent. Now, if I were building the system for me, I'm willing to just kind of do hacky things and just copy it and make up. It's like a secondary index, make complicated queries, because I'm willing to know the details. But in this case, the users cannot know, literally cannot know. They don't have the vocabulary to know about these structures. And furthermore, because the requirements are not stable, they have to be able to change those things. and change them really radically, even to changing the entire technology of the storage, if necessary. And that actually, in this complicated visibility constraints, search constraints, and so on, makes things much harder if you don't have the right tools. And Drill, by the way, spoiler alert, Drill is the right tool here, just in case you couldn't guess. They also want to be able to do pretty complicated joins, and joins against statistically subsampled versions of the data, you know, like who looked up the same weird stuff that he looked up. Well, what's weird? Well, that's a statistical question. So there's some join against some statistical summary table, and then maybe some subsampling of the things that he did. And then we're going to be doing queries of that to find him or her, whatever, whoever seems to be infected by the same strange problem. And so we're going to be going forward and backward and joining and things like that, complex join patterns. So systems like Druid, for instance, that basically just don't do joins or only you have indexes or cubing on some dimensions just aren't going to happen here. And it's, again, no full staging environment. All tests, everything, have to run live. And if you're going to insert a bunch of test data in the real table, users cannot see it. Okay, so the tools that we have available are Apache Drill. That was a coercion by me. They had Spark. They were willing to use Spark. And that's good because Drill doesn't have an insert. And then, hey, you know, I don't have that shirt on today. I don't have that hat on today. But we were pushing our platform, MapRDB, MapR file system in general. Now, some of the cool things about that... I'm going to talk about that just for a moment. It is part of the core of what we're talking about. Here, for instance, is... there you go. Can you actually see that now? I've logged into a MapR cluster. Some of the cool things there are I can do ls. My home directory is in the MapR file system. And in the MapR file system, these things, for instance... They look like files, except they have funny colors. Those are streams. But a MapRDB table fits in the file system. It is part of the file system. And it has some other characteristics as well. So it's got this data platform that they live on. And it provides very, very large scale. It provides secondary indexing, covered columns at the database level. And it's a very general data type. So we don't have to reduce everything to a fully relational form. Now, with some tools, that's a problem because they don't like flexible data. With Drill, that's really cool. And I've seen this be used in other places as well. XMapR engineer Jen Feng Ni went to Alibaba, and he's built this really cool time series database. And initially he used OpenTSDB, then he replaced the storage layer for OpenTSDB, but he still used the query structure for OpenTSDB. And I don't know if anybody's done it, but OpenTSDB has a few really cool time series-like capabilities, like it can interpolate values correctly. Most SQL cannot interpolate for anything. And that means it can do time alignment and it can do statistical operations on time-aligned values. But it's really quirky. It only does a few time series-like things. And his users have to use SQL. And Drill, like here, is a really cool interface layer where SQL on the top, quirky data structure below. Now, MapRDB is not nearly as quirky as OpenTSDB, but it's not a database of SQL form. It has special characteristics. Yeah?
In that situation that you just described, so he does use OpenTSDB, and then this SQL layer. So realizing that that's what somebody wants, why Drill? and why not some other SQL layer, or okay. It could have been anything in this situation.
So she's asking, I don't know if you can hear her, she's facing this way, why drill? Why did he use drill in that case? There are two big reasons that I think. One is drill is cool, and it allows very, very sophisticated push down, push up first of optimizer rules. So the data source can push up optimizer rules into the SQL optimizer, but then the query can push down, like, I want these columns, or this is the operation that I actually want. And so those two can work together. The data source, the OpenTSDB, can inform drill that this is how you should optimize queries that involve this data, and that optimization ultimately leads to only OpenTSDB capable things. Everything else stays outside of that. And then those queries do come in later. So that's one reason that he used it. Drill is cool. The other reason is he knows drill really well. And so that happens. That's a realistic reason.
But in fact, he's getting advantages there that people might not have known to look for.
He's getting advantages, but more importantly, a whole lot of Alibaba customers are getting advantages because that is the time series database that's exposed in Alibaba Cloud. So a critical thing there for him was to be able to be, we will come back. It will be okay. I promise.
I broke it with my question.
Yeah. But the important thing there is he needs to be wizardly to provide the capability to these thousands of projects, but then they need to be completely oblivious to the wizardly conduct. So it works for him. And that's going to work here as well. So they have raw logs that come in. Now they have some sophisticated collection stuff. We can do all that. That's what big data does, right? They run big Spark jobs. Now these Spark jobs are actually pretty darn complicated internally to reduce that data and parse it properly and join it with certain secondary information. It's one block here. Yeah, whatever. And then we actually just insert it into the live database. This is crazy talk, right, to do that. But what we do then internally inside MapRDB is it has a specialized change data capture channel, and then that's used to update all of the indices. Now, to make that less crazy, we mark all of the data that's inserted there with a job number. So that job number is on every row, and we remember which logged job we did, and then we can throw job numbers into a visibility table, or really an invisibility table, and at the beginning of the job, we can say job number 293 is beginning. Don't look. Don't think about that data. I'll tell you later if you can see it. And that visibility table is used in conjunction with these tables to control the visibility of half-baked stuff. And so then when they do the actual queries, they have live in the indexing, they have views, drill views for staging, and drill views for production. And the QA queries hit the staging view as if it were a table, and production queries hit the production view. And they can see radically different things as a result of those views, and they have no idea. We can even hide columns. We can make synthetic columns. We can do anything a SQL query can do, which is anything a program can do because UDFs and so on. Yeah.
I assume you created this visibility table, like you said, so that in-flight inserts are not visible until completion.
Precisely.
Now, what happens when it fails and you try to reinsert? Any issues with indexing, duplicate indices?
No, because those are new rows. They get indexed separately. And the visibility on the job ID in those rows, it'll be a new job.
So your primary index is not dependent on your data, but rather generated
Yeah. And so the visibility table is always tiny because it only shows the things you should not see. That might be 293 is in flight, as he just mentioned, but the other kind of in flight is deletions. So we want to just say, hey, 153 is no longer visible to anybody. It is now invisible. And now we can start working on deleting it. And we can throttle the deletion so that it doesn't impact other people's use. That's part of the multi-tenancy. It's how do these systems tasks not take the system out effectively. Then we can also label things like 292 as only visible in QA. That means only the QA users can see it, so they can be testing to make sure it's good. If it's not good, then we can start deleting it, mark it as deleted, and start a new insert job, which also goes to QA state when it's done. The live users never know that we're screwing around with their data. Once we get it right, we delete it from that table, and it becomes visible.
You can run into some concurrency issues here anyways.
Like yes.
I
love this guy. So, I mean, this is so good. On the previous slide, you ask about this, and then you ask about concurrency. So there we go. The contents of the join basically look like select whatever from a left join of live data and visible. And wherever the visible.state is null, meaning I don't have a row in the visibility table, then I can see it. Or, in this case, this is the QA view. If the state is QA, then it'll be visible there as well. Now, nobody will know the details of that view. They'll just think of it as a table. And so job numbers are in that visibility table. The only for impaired visibility jobs in there. So that visibility table is really tiny. It's going to have like 3-5 rows, something like that, in it at any given time. So it is physically tiny. It'll be hundreds of bytes at most. And that means that it's going to be... Yeah, well, I didn't say it there. But it's going to be less than 8K. And on essentially any file system in the world, but in particular on the MapR file system, okay, that just died. On the MapR file system, we can do atomic updates of a small file because it's one block. It is or it isn't. And that means we can do atomic updates of the visibility of this entire massive table because Drill reads that small file and does a broadcast join at the beginning of the query, and it reads that file only on a single machine in a single thread. So we have very, very nice... Yeah?
One question. Do you rely on the file being small for atomicity?
So he asks, do I rely on this small file for atomicity? I don't want to say yes, I mean, because there are other ways to do this, but in this case, I go, cool.
Yeah.
Game over.
Yeah,
we're done.
For free, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I'm willing to take it simple wins whenever I get them.
Yep.
And so, what we've done is we've focused in the visibility question to a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of data, and so now we get that easy win. Now, we could have done some other things. Like, we could have put that into a table. And we only care about doing mostly atomic things on a single job level. But it might be at some point that we want to replace a job with another one and don't want ever to have both or none or anything like that. So the table wouldn't be quite as nice for that. We can do pretty complicated updates to if we just replace the entire file. So I kind of like the file until it gets bigger.
Yeah.
But I'll fight to keep it small, is the situation. And it is a cheesy, sleazy thing to do. Cool. This is real world. Yeah?
How does deletion work? Either I have a job I need to change for each row, or how do you use a job ID in that case?
So for deletion, the question is, how does that actually work? In order to effectively delete a whole bunch of old data, the oldest job that's still in the table, all I have to do is add the row to the visibility table. So what if I'm going to delete just one record out of an entire job? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Don't do that. Well, I mean, I could do that, and it would, that row would disappear. But generally, I want to have more systematic control over this big table. I want to think of these as entire insertion transactions. And so mostly, I just don't do that. I might do that. I would never tell anybody I'd just done that because it would be so embarrassing. But mostly, we just put it in the visibility table. The entire job disappears from all queries. Now we start munching and actually doing the deletions. So, yeah. Now, this is like a form of transactions, effectively. We have transactions on that tiny table, where we can jump to new states. But it's cooler in other ways because I might have inserted some data and inserted more data, and I go, oh my God, that old data was wrong. I made a mistake. I didn't discover it till days later. I can roll back that insertion immediately if I want to. And you can't, I mean, with a transaction, once you've committed it, you can't go, oopsie. You know, start, commit, or start, rollback. It's not start, commit, oopsie. That's not part of the normal transaction. But here we have a lot of flexibility. And it's really, really nice. Now, remember I said this is not complicated? This is not PhD work. It shouldn't be. It should be simple. At this point, I have a mechanism that I can explain to users. I can explain to IT-type folks who are not database people, and they can get it right. I can leave. They can run it basically forever without any big deals. Now, there are other things. There's always going to be new requirements. These large systems are ponderous, and especially when you don't have a staging system, it is really scary and really dangerous to start changing this stuff. But Drill helps this because we can do essentially incremental data modeling. Where I said select star in the view before, I could actually put a list of columns. So now if I want to migrate the database so that three new columns appear, or some transformations of columns appear, and they're going to appear with the same names or different names, I can put that into the view. And I can start doing backfill on the database without telling anybody. It's invisible except for our QA view, and so we can now transform this data in very, very substantial ways, in ways that are inconceivable with a normal database, because they are so friggin' dangerous if you don't have some control over visibility. But we can now do this in ways that we would not otherwise be able to do. We can also then do some very, very interesting progressive analysis. A lot of the data we're going to get, not so much with DNS queries, but a lot of other kinds of data, we will understand parts of it, some corner of it, and we really won't understand most of it. If we do the traditional data modeling, if we say to people, and Ellen's going to talk a lot more about this, we say to this, you can't do anything until it's all imported into the data warehouse and all the data modeling's done, it will take forever. And furthermore, it will be wrong because we only understand a little part of our problem right now. We'll understand more later. So not only will it be a long time, it'll be wrong, so we'll have to do it again, and it'll be even longer. But with Drill, with these views, we can put into the view our understanding, our analysis of the data so far. And in network forensics, what you would often like to do is do a query against a network capture file. You don't want to import that into a data warehouse because it's big. and it's coming in really fast. You mostly don't even want to look at it. You just want to pull it in and then delete it. Pull it in, oh my God, something's happened, now I have to go look at it. And I want to pull stuff out of it, and then I want to understand more, and I want to pull different stuff out of it. So I want to be able to do this very flexibly. And Drill, for instance, can directly query network capture files. That's very cool. And because of the push down and the optimizers, it can scan these things in a single core at nearly wire speed. And if you have a lot of cores, if you have parallelism, it's really fast, which you do want to be able to do these queries faster than the data is coming in, which is very, very amazing. And you can also, because of that pushdown, that the reason it's so fast is because in doing these queries against network capture files, most of the data is not what you're looking at. You might be looking at how many touches were to a particular IP address, or what IP addresses did he touch. So I only care about the addresses here and counting, maybe number of bytes, things like that. And so I can skip most of that because Drill pushes down very effectively into the UDF. The UDF doesn't even have to parse all that data. If we were sucking it into a database, of course we'd have to parse everything that we might ever want to look at, and it would go much, much slower. So this is amazing. Here's another example of where this progressive sort of thing is really important. Here's a user agent string. It looks like garbage. It is garbage, basically, because it's been glued together in textual form since 1993 now, I guess, when the first web browser happened. And not only is it kind of agglomerated, but it's full of lies. So this thing says Safari. It's not Safari, but it happens to act like Safari, and so it says it's Safari, so that various web compatibility tests will say, oh, okay, I'll treat it like Safari. So these are complicated. Suppose I want to do a query. Give me all of the DNS requests or things like that that came from phones. Tell me, what are all of the user agent strings that look like phones? Well, Drill happens to have a very cool UDF that parses these things, and one of the first things it says, what's the device class? Now, if yesterday we didn't think about whether or not these attacks happened to phones, we wouldn't have extracted the data in order to do this, but today we can add that to our view. And so this sort of flexibility is still inherent in that whole big data design that we have here. So all of the parts that I don't understand yet can still work tomorrow. And by the way, the user agent, see the dot, dot, dot at the bottom? Well, there's more stuff that you can extract from that. And in fact, there's a whole lot more that comes out of that one user agent string. Turns out one crazy guy in Holland went to the work to parse all this. You don't want to parse all this all the time. You want to be opportunistic and directive about it, and tomorrow you want something else. And that's just so true. So, here's the summary. I'm going faster because we want some time for questions. Not that you guys are shy. Drill is cool. Drill has some really advanced capabilities, but the most important thing is that can use an advanced platform. It makes that platform viable and cooler because users can use it, and users can use it without being sophisticated. That's the most amazing kind of sophistication there is if it doesn't appear to be. If it's simple. So, that's the talk. I'm happy to ask questions or, you know, if you guys have comments. My guess is some of you are nodding. You've done this kind of thing or hit this kind of problem, hit this kind of data. It's ugly, but you know, it used to be so much worse. This really is a talk about how things can now be handled when they just really couldn't be well before. So don't feel compelled to just ask questions. Go on a diatribe or a polemic or something and tell me what you're working on too. If I meant, like, right now.
So I use Drill to set up. Basically, we have a lot of analysts with marketing, and not all of them have very technical expertise, right? So maybe Python script might be out of their grasp, but maybe they can cobble together some kind of SQL script to get a question out of that, or to do it Drill. And then there's all sorts of views of raw files that we have that are going to be like 500 megabytes every day generated for a particular client. I want to be able to show them, like, for example, where did all my ads serve, and were some of them out of the geos that I wanted to buy. So Apache Drill allows those analysts to, like, drop in these files ad hoc, do their analysis, get the output, put together their, like, pretty map, show their client all this other stuff, without having to know, oh shit, I have to, how am I going to parse all this data? How am I going to, you know, if they had to drop it in Python, I feel like it would just be beyond them, but just drop it in. Treated like SQL if there's any advanced. And actually, one of the cool things about the user-defined like schemas that you can have in Drill is you can set one up so that way any query when you're in that schema outputs a file for that query, which is awesome. Like, it's a mind-blowing event for them because they put in their query, they have output this massive CSV file or whatever they want. And it was a capability that they didn't even have. So,
mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing, so he's got marketing people. Can you hear in the back, hear people? Okay, that's awesome, if you can actually hear him. But I hear a common theme here that these users, I don't want to say cannot, but they do not want to. They have issues in their lives, they have jobs to do, that preclude them from spending the time to develop this apparently extraneous expertise. And so you can provide them a system that is apparently simple, and they can get on with their jobs without having to become amazing data parsing things. And you can separate complexities, separate parsing with the parsing people, and but that sounds like science fiction, doesn't it? The parsing people, and let the data interesting, customer focused sophistication to be over there, and the parsing people don't have to think about that.
Right.
That's the same thing here, is that sophistication can be hidden. Yeah. So, do you use Drill?
Me?
Yeah, you.
No, I don't, but actually, your use case is very interesting because the company I work for, we do like some consulting work for the DoD, and we help them analyze a data source recently that also did DNS data, but the way they do it is really broken, and I think this would be a good way for them to optimize it. So we'll definitely have to talk to them about this.
Cool.
But they basically just like throw all their stuff into HDFS and just like getting stuff out of there. For, like, my team and I, it took us like a couple of days, and we wanted to get like a whole bunch of information for like a single day.
Yeah, oh, totally. And furthermore, the worst case is when they have to call you and the guy with security clearance isn't around, and
right.
And they can't tell you what they're doing, and they can't tell you what their data is, and they can't even tell you what it's like, and you kind of have to guess. And it's such a nightmare. You might think we have customers like that. I couldn't possibly comment. But yeah, I feel your pain. I have a long time. Drill is really cool for this ad hocery. Where you need to hide the ad hoc nature and let them use Tableau or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, simplify the world for them. Sounds all righteous, take on the burdens and so on. but it is. I mean, it really is. It's separating complexities. Okay, well, I think we're about out of time. Thanks very much. And obviously, you can get in touch with me. I'm happy to talk. Obviously, I talk too much. Because we're out of time. But I think this is really an exciting set of tools and exciting sorts of things that we can do, which make this much less of a just the priesthood gets to access this data, and much more people get to access it. And I think Ellen's going to talk more about the implications of the people side of that. So thank you very much.